Blog Talk Radio.
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back my job again.
Now I don't want your Rolls Royce, mister. I don't want pleasure, yeah. All I want, just food for my baby, give to me my old job back.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, it's Progressive News Network. I'm your host, News Director Rick Spezak, welcoming you. And also, I want to welcome my good friend and associate producer, Ms. Renee Shaker. Renee?
Hey, Rick. Hi.
It's good to have you all with us tonight. We've got some wonderful guests, some great information for you. We've got Senator Jeff Clemens coming on at 7:30. We've got a report from Trish Shelton on that up-and-coming Stop Monsanto event next Saturday. We've got Susan Howell giving us an update on the ridiculous changes the legislature has made to the foreclosure situation. And then we've got a report from a colleague out west, Marjorie Hansen, also known as Turbo Kitty, who's going to be talking about some of the issues that she's chasing. So now, the news. Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to declare the end of posse comitatus. The most objectionable aspect of the new regulatory change is the inclusion of vague language that permits military intervention in civilian affairs in event of civil disturbances. According to this revised rule, federal military commanders now have the authority in extraordinary emergency circumstances where prior authorization by the president is impossible and duly constituted local authorities are unable to control the situation to engage temporarily in activities that are necessary to quell large-scale, unexpected civil disturbances. Bruce Afran, civil liberties attorney and constitutional law professor at Rutgers, calls the rule a wanton power grab by the military. That's the U.S. military. And says it's quite shocking, actually, because it violates the long-standing presumption that the military is under civilian control. Yeah. Okay, this news from Fukushima. How the Fukushima contamination may have spread via inland waterways. This is a story we haven't heard yet. A new study offers fresh insights into how radioactive contamination from the Fukushima nuclear disaster may have spread through Japan's interconnected waterways, reaching some freshwater fish hundreds of kilometers away. Research by two Japanese academics published in Nature magazine late last month reports traces of cesium found in 2011 even in Shizuoka Prefecture, 400 kilometers southwest from the plant. Although the data has been available the year of the accident from Japanese government fisheries agency, this is the first time the data has been compiled and analyzed to try to assess exactly how and how far the damage has spread. The data has been there, but has not been very accessible. Toshiaki Mizuno, one of the co-authors of the report, toured JRK. According to the authors, the new study is important because it draws attention to a water system characteristic that may be unique to Japan. Because Japan's irrigation system is so advanced, the speed with which radioactive substances spread is also very fast. Hidekiya Kubo, the other co-author, told JRK. As the Nature article says, there are not only many source points of water springs and many rivers and streams, but also a high-density water network system of irrigation canals and urban water systems. Research for the article was conducted at the Center for Risk Research at Shiga University in western Japan. Dr. Mizuno specializes in freshwater ecology, risk analysis, governance, and corporate social responsibility. Wow, he's right at the nub of things. At Lake Biwa Environmental Research Institute, also in the Shiga Prefecture. He worked formerly for 7 years for the World Wildlife Fund's Japan Freshwater Program. Dr. Kubo teaches economics at Shiga and specializes in insurance and risk management. Oh boy. As part of the research, the authors focus in particular on contamination of freshwater fish throughout Japan, as opposed to contamination in saltwater fish considered to have had the greatest exposure due to the large dumping of radioactive water into the waters off the shore of the stricken plant in the weeks following the accident. Oh, which, by the way, you know, continues. The Nature article, based on data collected in 2011, notes that the radioactive cesium in freshwater fish in several locations, particularly near Fukushima, were well above the official government levels considered safe for consumption. While fish near Fukushima still exceed the safety levels, recent tests have shown little contamination in freshwater sources outside the immediate area. The authors propose that by monitoring contamination levels in freshwater fish, specifically a species called ayu, may be one innovative way to track how far radioactive material can spread. Freshwater fish inhabit all types of water systems, they wrote in the Nature piece, and as a result, the level of freshwater contamination can be taken as an index of the environmental contamination of the freshwater system. IU can be found in practically every river across Japan. Weather forecasts are based on monitors across the country. I think it's necessary to create a similar monitoring system for the IU, noticing radioactivity based on the IU. So far, government officials have been slow in reacting to the fish as monitor idea, however. Oh, that's an interesting one. Okay, also, we have another story. This is along the anti-GMO lines. Early Sunday morning, French police stood helpless as 60 people locked inside an open-air field of genetically modified grapevines uprooted every plant. In Spain last month, dozens of people destroyed two GMO fields. In the millennial cusp, Indian farmers burned BT cotton in their cremate Monsanto campaign. Ignored by multinational corporations and corrupt public policymakers, citizens act to protect the food supply and the planet. French vineyard in the same field attacked last year when the plants were only cut. But security features installed after that incident kept authorities at bay while the group accomplished its mission yesterday. Speaking for the group, Olivier Florent told Le Figaro that they condemned the use of public funds for open field testing of GMOs that we do not want. Pitching tents in the rain near France's National Institute for Agronomic Research, the INRA site, in Colmar the night before, the group waited until 5 a.m. before converging on the site and locking the gates behind them. They uprooted all 70 plants, then submitted to arrest. This is the second attack on GMO crops to make international news this year. In July, dozens of people destroyed two experimental corn crops in Spain. In an anonymous press release, they wrote, "This kind of direct action is the best way to respond to the fait accompli policy through which then the Generalitat, the state, and the biotech multinationals have been unilaterally imposing genetically modified organisms." In the late 1990s, Indian farmers burnt BT cotton fields in their cremate Monsanto campaign. Monsanto did not disclose to the farmers that GM seeds were experimental, despite the heavy use of chemical fertilizer, traces of which can still be observed in the field. The BT plant grew miserably, less than half the size of traditional cotton plants in the adjacent fields. In the U.S., GMOs were secretly foistered on the public in the mid-1990s, and only now is the U.S. Supreme Court addressing this scourge. In June, the High Court upheld partial deregulation of GM alfalfa, which permits limited planting, while the USDA prepares an environmental impact statement. Natural and organic alfalfa supply is threatened by the very real potential of GM contamination. This would destroy the organic meat and dairy industry. Last Friday, federal court took a tougher stand on GM sugar beets. Judge Jeffrey S. White revoked the USDA's approval of GM beets while allowing for its planting this year only. Also this month, a British farmer exposed that milk and meat from cloned animals had secretly entered the food supply. Public opposition to GM crops has grown in recent years as more evidence surfaces that DNA-altered crops, A, require massive chemical inputs which destroy local biodiversity and poison the water table, B, cross-pollinate with natural and weedy crops, C, create superweeds, and D, have been shown to cause organic damage, sterility, and diabetes and obesity in mammals. Meanwhile, President Obama has stacked his administration with biotech insiders, going so far as to appoint Islam Siddiqui as agriculture trade negotiator. Siddiqui is a former pesticide lobbyist and vice president of Crop Life America, a biotech and pesticide trade group that lobbies to weaken environmental laws. Hey, that's our kind of guy. The U.S. is pushing hard at the world to accept GM foods. Recently, the American Farm Bureau Federation has called for stronger sanctions against European Union for its GM crop ban. But as governments and trade agreements circumvent the will of the people, some take matters into their own hands. The rise in GMO crop destruction is a clear indication that the world's peoples reject chemical and genetic pollution of the food supply and the environment. And in a following story, former FDA officials complain about GMO labeling movement. Science doesn't always win, he said. Whether the food industry likes it or not, when it comes to GMO labeling, the train appears to have left the station, according to former FDA Associate Commissioner of Foods, Dr. David Acheson. Dr. Acheson, who now heads up the Food and Import Safety Division at the consultancy Levitt Partners, was speaking to Food Navigator USA as a GMO labeling bill passed its first regulatory hurdle in Vermont, and members of Congress examine a federal bill proposed by Senator Barbara Boxer and Congressman Pete DeFazio. The last thing the food industry wants is 50 different laws in 50 different states. He added, I think it's only a matter of time before one state GMO labeling proposal is successful, and the last thing they want is 50 different laws. So the thinking is that if it's going to happen, it'd be better to have one standard that's national. They can't afford to oppose it in 50 states. I think there may be an attitude of let's just do it now, work with the FDA to create a national labeling law, and get it over with, because ultimately we'll lose the argument. Meanwhile, global food companies are already having to navigate GMO labeling laws in other markets, he said. I think many food companies are hoping that after California's GMO labeling initiative, Prop 37, was defeated, the issue would, you know, just go away, like the Corexit and the BP oil in the Gulf. What's the purpose of food labeling? But while the outcome of this debate may appear inevitable, he said, let's not confuse consumers' appropriate desire to know what they are eating with risk-based labeling for the purposes of public health. The issue for legislators is complex, however. Does there have to be a food safety risk or nutritional issue for labeling to be warranted? Or do consumers have a right to know, regardless? What is the purpose of labeling, he asked. The issue was a constant subject of debate when he was at the FDA, said Dr. Acheson, not the least because there was only a limited amount of space on food labels, meaning that anything that has to be there by law should be there for a reason. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to bring on my associate producer, Ms. Renee Shaker, who's got an interesting report for you. Renee, take it away.
Thanks, Rick. In combing through the press this week, I'm sure everybody has heard about all the scandals besetting our president with the IRS and the Associated Press and Benghazi. And I want to focus on the IRS situation. Now, you know, normally something like this wouldn't warrant our attention because it's just a lot more right-wing hysteria. Republicans trying to make political fodder over something that's not there. But there's some disturbing elements behind all this. And not only is the press not picked up on these elements, but they're actually not reporting what the real issue is. And I'm sure, as most of you know by now, the scandal arose when it became public that the IRS was supposedly singling out groups, advocacy groups, with the name Tea Party or Patriot or some other labeling that would have indicated that they were a conservative group in their applications for tax-exempt status. And let me read to you quickly. Lois Lerner, the director of the IRS's tax-exempt organizations office, the comments or the report that she made regarding this incident. We get about 60,000 applications for tax exemption every year. Most of them are 501c3 organizations, your run-of-the-mill charities. But between 2010 and 2012, we started seeing a very big uptick in the number of 501c4 applications we were receiving, and many of these organizations applying more than doubled, from about 1,500 in 2010 to over 3,400 in 2012. So we saw a big increase in these kinds of applications, many of which indicated that they were going to be involved in advocacy work. So what the IRS normally does is they centralize applications in various areas in which there's a large increase. In this case, they centralize all the cases coming in for 501c4 advocacy exemptions. And these cases were sent to the Cincinnati office. She said that this is something we do whenever we see an uptick in a new kind of application or something that we haven't seen before. Lois then goes on to say, however, in these cases, the way they did the centralization was not so fine. Instead of referring to the cases as advocacy cases, they actually use case names on the list. They use names like Tea Party or Patriots, and then selected cases simply because the application had those names in the title. They did not do this because of any political bias. They did it because they were working together, and this was a streamlined way for them to refer to the cases. They didn't have the appropriate level of sensitivity about how this might appear to others and that it was just wrong. So when we found out about it, we did a couple of things. First, we said that the list that goes around for centralizing cases, any changes on that list have to be reviewed and approved at the Director of Rulings and Agreements level, so line staff can no longer change or add to that list without calling us to look at it. So basically what the IRS said is you can't pick and choose names out of a group. You have to treat the whole group equally, regardless of what the names those particular organizations are. Now, that's the skinny of all this. The bigger question is, why did this happen? Why is this turning into such a scandal? And the reason for that has to do with Citizens United. Back in 2010, which opened the floodgates of money, the IRS, which was just pointed out in the report that I just read, had a huge increase in the number of applications for 501c4 status. Now, there's a distinction here. 501c3, as I mentioned, are your normal charities. And anybody who accepts, or I should say donations that are made to 501c3 organizations are tax exempt. But the other animal that is arisen primarily because of Citizens United is the 501c4. And the distinction is that a 501c4 is not a charity, but is allowed to engage in what's called social welfare. The problem is the IRS never determined or defined what social welfare actually means. The other issue is that these social welfare groups, in order to receive tax-exempt status, can engage in no more than 49% of its operations in the political arena. Now, there was a report issued by the Treasury Department's Inspector General who confirmed that no one outside the IRS had pressured staff members to look more closely at Tea Party groups. The agency's mistake was made in-house, and the report uncovered no evidence that it was the result of political pressure from the White House, as many Republicans are charging. Instead, it was a group of mid-level employees who decided to search for the phrase Tea Party and other keywords used by conservative groups in identifying and evaluating applications to become tax-exempt social welfare groups. The report goes on to say that the practice was inexcusable because social welfare groups of all political stripes, known as 501c4 organizations, had for years abused their tax exemptions through excessive political activity, and the IRS should have cracked down on them without regard to ideology. In July 2011, the director of the tax-exempt organization's office told employees to stop singling out Tea Party groups and instead focus on whether any groups might be more active in politics than in social welfare. There's a clear reason this problem kept arising at the IRS, and it is the same reason that social welfare groups were allowed to overrun the political process with secret cash in the last three elections. Some groups carefully spend only 49% of their money on politics, while others, including the one founded by Karl Rove, do nothing but politics while claiming they are engaged in social welfare work. The IRS employees did not understand the rules, the Inspector General said, largely because the rules barely exist. So what's happened is we've had a huge increase in tax-exempt applications that have gone to the IRS by these so-called social welfare organizations who are expressly limited by law in the amount of efforts they can undertake in the political arena. But the IRS never issued regulations clearly defining what social welfare is, nor has there been any attempt up until recently to take a look at these organizations to see if they are abusing their tax-exempt status and engaging in political activities above and beyond that 49% threshold. Now, I don't think any of us are naive enough to believe that all these organizations really are engaged in true social welfare, and that many of these are intended as purely vehicles for the funneling of money that can influence elections. And the IRS's ability to track these organizations' activities and to crack down on these abuses are in no doubt going to be hampered by all this hysteria, which is not focused on the right thing. It's focused on things that have nothing to do with whether or not the IRS is doing its job, but it's another case of Republicans making political hay and basically changing the story to achieve their own agenda. Now, what's disturbing about this, aside from what I've already discussed, are two things. Number one, our president basically threw his own people under the bus on this. Instead of standing up and defending Steve Miller, who was the acting head of the IRS, he asked for his resignation and has promised that more heads are going to roll and there'll be more investigations and yada, yada, yada. When clearly nothing wrong was done, nothing wrong was being perpetrated here. And then the other thing that's most disturbing about all this is the right's ability in changing the subject and creating another arena of hysteria that's putting pressure on our government. Now, I'm no lover of government. I have my gripes with the government as much as the next person. But what's happening here is that this is part of their longstanding strategy to discredit government and to reduce the public's confidence in our government as part of their broader strategy of starving the beast and withholding funds and so on and so forth. So I did a little research, and everybody complains about how government is so intrusive and how government is really out there abusing its role. And if we look at the federal employment levels in this country as a percent of the total labor force, these numbers peaked in 1968 at about 4%. In other words, about 4% of the entire country was employed by the federal government out of our total workforce. Those numbers have been coming down year after year after year, steadily and without interruption, so that by the end of last year, the number of civilian employees, and this is non-military, federal employees as part of our workforce dropped to about 1.7%. Basically, we have cut our civilian labor, our federal workforce by more than half when you look at their representation in the total labor force over the past 25 years, actually 35 years. And the other thing I looked at is everybody screams about how much money the government's spending and how much it's wasting. So I took a look at how much the federal government has been spending on regulations in this country. And it's amazing how little this government does spend in protecting the citizens of this country. I have broken out federal spending and regulations between social, which covers groups like the Food and Drug Administration, the Federal Aviation Administration, the Federal Housing Authority, OSHA, and so on and so forth. And those numbers stand at, are you ready for this shocking figure, 0.3%. In other words, our government spends, as a percentage of our entire economy, 0.3%. That's 0.003 on federal regulations in the social arena. If you look at the economic arena, which covers the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the Federal Reserve, the IRS, the Comptroller of the Currency, those numbers stand at 0.05%. That is 0.0005. So what we have is, and this doesn't, this, by the way, this does not even include a lot of our agencies that are self-funded, like the SEC, which derives a lot of its income from fees that assesses on the industry. Government is something that is most appreciated when it's lacking. No one notices government efficiency when millions of Social Security checks go out on time, but everybody would take note if a drug was sent to market that makes people ill. Unfortunately, the ideological divide, which has intensified over the past few decades, has been recruiting more and more people to the false belief that government is bad and should be minimized if not eliminated, that government is solely a consumer of resources while overlooking the contributions it makes to our economic growth beyond military spending, that is corrupt and inefficient without acknowledging the destruction to our food quality, our transportation safety, our national parks, our air and water quality, and the thousands of other aspects of our lives that would deteriorate in its absence, that its workers are lazy and ignorant while discarding the thousands of people we never hear about who have dedicated their lives to public service and do a genuinely good job, and that it serves only the interests of the wrong people while failing to appreciate all the benefits that accrue to each of us in terms of affordable homeownership, retirement benefits, health care, higher education, air transportation, food, air, and water safety, and so forth. Yet today, instead of thoughtful governments, we have Washington engaged in games of vituperative politics and a GOP that has become dominated by corrosive rhetoric of an extreme radical right. We have an entire party with a long, noble tradition in the governance of our nation. Even its leadership of thoughtful men and women, today held hostage by a militant, fanatical, and destructive cabal of hate and anger-filled neophytes who carry the message of, and whose elections are the product of, a handful of extremely rich men filled with no other interest than in further lining their own pockets, and only see our government and most of the people in this country as standing in their way. Using time-honored traditions of preying on ignorance and anger, these men, and yes, they are primarily men, have convinced enough of the electorate of their anti-government rhetoric to get these fanatics elected, a reactionary group of men and women who have no interest in governing their mission progress on important issues. Instead, they hold office solely to play the most destructive of political games, hobbling the government to the point where its citizenry at large loses all confidence in it. Supporting this anti-government hysteria has been a 30-year public relations crusade to discredit government, starting with Reagan's declaration that government is not the solution, government is the problem. And we have ultra-right media outlets, conservative think tanks, and Tea Party electioneering platforms who've waged a systematic, bitter, and relentless program to convince the American public of the inefficiency and ineffectiveness of government. The success of this campaign is evident in surveys that show a large majority, 70% of the people in this country, believe that government creates more problems than it solves. Then, pointing to the resulting ineffectiveness brought on by withholding resources and leadership, critics claim to have the excuse, if not the evidence, for more attacks on government programs, policies, and laws that they don't like. And unfortunately, this is just another case where using some hapless employees in an IRS backwater who are not given the resources, the leadership, or even the guidance to do their job, taking it upon themselves to try to ferret out abuses in the system being used by Republicans and right-wing fanatics as further evidence that our government is corrupt, and in particular, the Obama administration is nothing but a socialist, as we all know. So it's a sad situation.
Well, thank you so much, Renee. That's an issue, or at least an issue that's important to a gang of irresponsible fanatics on the right. Okay. Well, let's go on. We're expecting a call any minute now from the good Senator Jeff Clements. And if he doesn't come on, we'll just bring on some of our other talent. And meanwhile, we'll go back to the news. And before I do the news, I do want to mention our good colleagues in the progressive media, who you should also take a chance to listen to. First, a shout-out to our good friend Gwen Holden-Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters. Gwen's a little under the weather, so send some positive thoughts out to Gwen. Gwen, we need you back in the fight. Hope you're feeling better soon. Also, we want to mention Susan Nylon and her Nylon Report, Sita Beguile and her show Sita Media. Also want to mention Anita Stewart and her show Wise Women, another fantastic, good progressive show. The good lady Harriet Lehrman and her show The Voice of the People. And the incomparable Mr. Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy. And also we do want to mention our other good friend of the show, Emily Dillick, and her show, Progressive Press. It's an online newsletter and a blog, so I hope you check that out. These are all good progressive people who are bringing you the best kind of content you could possibly ask for. And what I'm going to go ahead and do is we're going to go back to the news and bring you another couple news stories while we're waiting for the good senator to call us in.
Rick, before you go on,
sure, go ahead.
I actually have a piece that is more bad news, but may lead to some good news.
Well, Renee, take it away.
Okay. I found a piece in the New York Times on, as we all know, the Republican obstruction of the president's nominees, even at the cabinet level. And as of this writing, which was just a few days ago, nominees at all levels of Washington's bureaucracy 117 of them in all, including cabinet secretaries, judges, and members of various oversight boards, are facing delays. Just last week, the Senate confirmed David Medin, the president's choice to lead the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, but the time between his nomination and confirmation was 510 days. And not surprisingly, every Republican voted no. So now there's a showdown going on between Gina McCarthy, who is Mr. Obama's choice to lead the Environmental Protection Agency, and Thomas Perez, the president's nominee to be Secretary of Labor. They were approved in committee with only Democratic votes. The Republicans didn't even participate. And their nominations now go to the full Senate, where they face likely Republican filibusters. Now, that's the bad news. The good news, maybe, is that Democrats say that Senator Harry Reid, in recent days, has been trying to gauge whether there is sufficient support among Democrats to force a rule change that would limit the filibuster on presidential nominees.
And ladies and gentlemen, with that, let me bring on the good senator, Senator Jeff Clemons.
Richard, how are you doing?
Very good, sir. Very good. I want to welcome you to tonight's show. How are you doing tonight?
Well, trying to recover a little bit from a long session, and I chose to move and close on a house the week after session. So it's been pretty hectic, but I appreciate you having me on.
Well, you could borrow my truck if I still had it. So tell me, sir, of the high points and low points, what are some of the memorable moments for you in this past session?
Well, it's, I guess, somewhat disappointing that we measure, or at least I measure our sessions in Florida by how much damage they do as opposed to how much good they do. But that really is kind of how we've looked at them for the past several years, with the past couple of years just being terrible. And this year was not terrible. It was better than terrible. So maybe that's a victory in this state. I'm not altogether sure. I think the highlights for me were killing a couple of bad bills in the Senate, which was great. The parent trigger bill, it went down in flames. The bill that would have changed the Florida retirement system forever went down in the Senate. So those are the kinds of things that I think I'm there for, is to try to kill bad legislation. And the fact that we were able to do that was pretty exciting for me, actually.
Well, that's great. We celebrate those victories, and we absolutely thank you for the hard work that you have to do in that uphill battle up there. If you were to talk about some of the good points, good things it accomplished, what would be? I know it'd be a little harder to find, but are there any? Is there any good news you can bring us, sir?
Well, yeah. Look. It's different being in the Senate. I spent 2 years in the House, and in the Senate, I've at least got the opportunity to pass some bills, to work on some things in the state budget that I didn't have previously. So one of the things I was most proud of is we passed a pretty wide-ranging ethics bill, and it didn't have everything that I wanted in it, but it is a good step in the right direction, and they took some of the language from a bill that I filed and inserted it into that bill, having to do with not voting on anything that you have financial interests in. So, again, didn't go as far as I wanted it to, but to have some of my language inserted in that bill and to have that bill passed, I think, was a thrill. And then I passed another bill with a local colleague of mine, Representative David Kerner, that it will help with some of the human trafficking issues that we have in Florida, which is a problem that a lot of people don't even know exists. But these women who are brought in from overseas countries and used, we passed a bill that will help deal with that issue anyway.
Well, that's fantastic. There's so much that we can be thankful for. They didn't pass more restrictions on women's health, and the stopping of that trigger bill is so important. Could you talk to us a little bit about those discussions, how those bills were discussed and described in the Senate?
Yeah, of course, and I'm very fortunate. We really didn't take up very many, if any, anti-women bills in the Senate or on the Senate floor. They did in the House, and they wasted a few days worth of debate over there over bills.
But we call that progress here in Florida.
Right, exactly, and isn't that somewhat sad? But so that was lucky, and really I'm grateful that in the Senate we didn't have to deal with any of those issues as far as the anti-women issues and anti-choice. But in the arena of education, there were a couple things that we did that were disturbing, and again, the parent trigger being one that very grateful that we were able to kill that bill. On a pretty close vote. It was a 22-18 vote. So you can see those margins are very slim, and they require a lot of work.
Senator Clemens, for people who aren't aware of what that parent trigger bill is really about, if you could explain that to people. I mean, those of us who are, you know, follow the legislature closely have a sense of it. But if you could take a minute or two and kind of describe what's being triggered, what are parents doing, how does that have anything to do with education, if it does?
Of course.
And if you could kind of explain that, that'd be a good thing, I think.
Yeah. I'll give you the version that they would like to talk about, and then I'll give you the reality as well. But the concept behind the parent trigger, as it's so-called, it began in California, and the idea is that if a school is failing, that parents can petition to have the school converted into a charter school and thus avoid some of the state regulations that come with schools and that charter schools avoid. On its surface, that sounds relatively benign. You know, you've got a school that's just not doing very well. Parents want control over the school. But what, in essence, what has happened in California is that these private education companies have come in and have basically taken over the process, have spent money to convince parents that this is the direction they need to go in, and it's been an absolute disaster. So what it really is about is the privatization of our education system. And, you know, the bill has been rolling around in the Florida legislature for a few years last year, and it died last year, I think, on a 21-19 vote in the Senate. And the worry this year and the prevailing thought was it was going to pass this year, because even though the Democrats picked up two seats in the Senate this year, we lost probably four, maybe five, what you might consider to be moderate Republicans who had voted against the parent trigger last year. So a lot of people thought it was kind of a fait accompli that it was going to pass this year, and somehow we were able to cobble together enough votes and convince enough people to have that bill fail on a 20-20 vote, which obviously is as close as you can get. But a bill has to have a majority plus one in order to pass. So it was it's one of those things, again, where, you know, you get a lot of good feeling when you see one of your own bills pass and when you see something good move forward. But I really feel, as the loyal opposition in the Florida legislature, our job is really to kill these bad bills. And I can't tell you how good it feels to know that the privatization efforts failed for another year, at least, in the Florida legislature.
Now, there was a lot of political muscle on the pro privatization side. Was our ex former governor's hand visible?
Yeah, it certainly wasn't with me. I think he knows. You know, Governor Bush knows better than probably to check in with several of us on the Democratic side. But there was certainly some pressure put on both through the media and through back channels. And look, you know, we all know where this is coming from. I mean, there's profit to be made in educating children. And wherever there's profit to be made, you know, there's lobbying money. So there's been several articles, well done journalistic pieces out there that have shown just how much money individuals or groups have made off our education system and off our tax dollars over the years. And, you know, it's one thing if they could just show proof that charter schools perform better than public schools, regular public schools, but that proof doesn't exist. Some charter schools do perform well. Others perform terribly, just like public schools. So, the genius of our American democracy really is based, in my estimation, on our public school system and the fact that everybody has the equal opportunity to a free public education. And that's even in the Florida Constitution. So maybe someday we'll actually honor that by not trying to privatize our education system every year in Tallahassee.
You know, it's part and parcel of the overall Republican plan nationally. Maybe some say, you know, supported by Alec, and some just say there's a mad genius in the land pushing these things. But it's part of kind of the idea of strip mining public resources and privatizing them. One of the things I think is most disheartening about it is that not only do they want to turn the schools over to private hands, but then they want to have us continue to pay for it while they profit from it. And it seems to me that talking about the profit side of schools is really an absolutely misguided way to do it. Another arena of debate and discussion is this whole idea of local control, and where we saw the government, the Republicans, push very hard to prevent local municipalities and government agencies to make additional laws regarding job control or hours or vacation time. Could you talk about that? It seems to me one of the most bizarre, counterintuitive arguments for the right to make, because if on the one hand their argument is power should be localized, you shouldn't have it from the state level or the national level, and here we have a Republican argument that says, no, we want to control this at the state level. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. And I think you summarized it to a certain extent that basically we're all for local control until our big businesses tell us that we shouldn't be all for local control. And that manifested itself this year, and the issue really revolved around Orange County. There was a group of citizens that got together up there to try to put an issue on the ballot to vote in Orange County, basically mandating that that businesses within Orange County should have to offer sick time. Now, there were commissioners up there who tried to make sure that it wouldn't get on the ballot, and it went back and forth, and there's a lot of underhandedness to the politics that were taking place up there. And so what the Florida legislature did, or I should say certain members of the Florida legislature, tried to step in and mandate how local governments can or cannot deal with those kinds of issues. And the original bill was just horrific. It basically not only said that local governments couldn't have mandates on sick time, but also they couldn't have mandates on wage theft, on numerous issues, basically just taking all local control out of the hands of government. And that was the House bill, and it was terrible. The Senate bill was not good, but it mainly just focused on the sick time issue and didn't stray into other areas like wage theft and other things along those nature. So it was interesting and really, I guess, like, as you kind of alluded to, somewhat hypocritical to listen to the arguments, because we time and time again hear from Republicans in Tallahassee that, you know, local control is a good thing, that they're tired of Washington, D.C. telling the state of Florida what to do, and yet then you see the same group of folks, you know, wanting to tell people in Orange County or in other places in the state of Florida what they can and can't do. Look, if you live in a community and that community decides that they want to live in a place where businesses have to offer paid sick time to their employees, and that's what the residents of that community want, then so be it. You know, I don't think it's state government's role to say, no, sorry, you can't do that. It was a disappointment, definitely.
Well, thanks so much. I think that shed a little more light on it for us. Another area of, I'm just going to call a spade, health hypocrisy on the part of our Republican legislators. Here we see health care turned away. And where the federal government was offering to fund this for several years of full tilt, They just couldn't see their way of letting Floridians have a healthier life.
This was politics, pure and simple. It was extremely disappointing. What we had here was the opportunity to expand Medicaid and accept, over the next 10 years at least, $50 billion worth of money to help ensure almost a million Floridians who are going without insurance right now. And look, I understand politics. I'm a politician, just like every other legislator. And I understand that there were Republicans who just couldn't get their head around going back to their constituents and saying, yes, I supported President Obama's push to expand Medicaid. So the Senate came up with a relatively ingenious plan, a way to accept the dollars and insure those people without necessarily calling it Medicaid expansion, by using some other state programs to do that. And you know what? That's fine. I mean, to me, it's neither here nor there. As long as we're insuring more people and we're taking those federal dollars, which really are our own tax dollars, we're getting them back from the federal government, then great. But the Florida House, and especially the Speaker of the House and a couple of other members, basically decided that accepting that federal money was wrong. And I just, for the life of me, can't see conceivably how someone could look someone in the eye and say, you know, I'm sorry, I don't want to use your own tax dollars to be able to make sure that you have access to good health care. They basically have left, you know, hundreds of thousands of Floridians hanging by their inability or their desire to not do anything that looks like they approve of something the president has done. That is, it's really unconscionable. I just don't understand how anyone could you know, walk away from $50 billion worth of our own tax money to help insure people who are uninsured. And you know, what's interesting about it is this wasn't a business community versus the liberals issue. This was the business community was entirely behind expansion of Medicaid or using those dollars because they understand that, you know, having a healthy community is good for everybody. The hospitals, all those folks were supportive. About the only people who weren't were a few members of the Florida House of Representatives and some Tea Party folks. And as a result, right now, we're not going to be accepting those federal dollars, our own tax dollars, in order to be able to provide health care for folks.
And yet I understand that the legislature's got a very fine, inexpensive health care program for themselves.
You know, yeah, I mean, what's interesting about it is the Senate this year voted to increase our contribution to that program. The House did not. So that's the real irony there, is that the Senate voted to increase our own contribution to our health care plan and to accept those federal dollars to be able to insure those folks. And we voted 39-1. There was only one state senator who voted against that. And then the House did not increase their own personal contribution to their health care plan and yet voted to deny health care. You know, not only unconscionable, but just really a poor public relations move, if nothing else. I mean, you'd think somebody would be smart enough to think, gee, if we're going to deny health care to 900,000 Floridians, maybe we should not, you know, keep our super cheap health care at the same time. But, you know, I guess hypocrisy knows no bounds.
Well, I'm sure the Democratic Party is going to eventually make hay out of that. They really.
Well, there's no question. And if you know the Speaker of the House, Will Weatherford, he's a bright guy, really nice person. I get along with him personally. I think he's, you know, seems like a decent guy in person. But he made some major mistakes this session. He's seen as a future conservative star. But I think, you know, he made some major mistakes. That was one of them, you know, not being willing to accept our own tax dollars back in order to be able to insure 900,000 Floridians. The other big one was he really pushed for campaign finance reform, but his campaign finance reform was very hollow and included originally, his original suggestion, increases from $500 per person contribution to $10,000. I'll say that again because it's hard for some people to get their heads around. $500 going from $500 per person or business entity to $10,000 per person or business entity. He somehow thought that was a good idea, at a time where we're trying to get more money out of politics to increase the amount that somebody can give. And I think that those are a couple of decisions that are going to haunt him politically in the future.
Well, I certainly hope that the Democratic Party digs in on these just incredibly incomprehensible votes and just completely undermining the public good. Do you think there's a chance that Governor Scott, in desperate need of some kind of election platform, is going to call a special session for health care?
I've thought about it, and look, I'm guessing like just like anybody else, but my guess is no, and here's why. He had an opportunity to use the bully pulpit during session on that issue. He could have, and he used it on two other things. He used it on raises for teachers, which I think we're going to do anyway, and he used it on a manufacturing tax cut, which I voted against and really frankly thought it was relatively useless. But those were the two things he used his little bully pulpit on. And you can use that bully pulpit as a governor because, look, you have a line item veto power. So you can go into that budget, which he's doing right now, by the way. We expect the budget to be approved by the governor either tomorrow or Tuesday with line item vetoes. And you can threaten those line item vetoes. And he didn't do that as it relates to health care. So I don't know what he gains out of it. In order for them to call a special session, there really has to be a solution devised beforehand. Because if you call people back to Tallahassee and you still don't get a solution, it's a public relations disaster for the governor. My guess is unless they come up with something pretty quickly over the next few weeks in terms of a solution that the House Republicans could buy into, that he won't call a special session because it could end up blowing up in his face.
So you see no signs of any negotiations going on?
I don't. That doesn't mean that it's not happening behind the scenes. Obviously, I'm a freshman Democrat in the Florida Senate, and they wouldn't come to me to talk about such a negotiation.
You might not be on that memo list, huh?
Exactly. But that being the case, I'm trying to think politically in terms of what he gains. Now, certainly Floridians gain if we call a special session and come up with a solution on this health care issue, I think. But I just think there's more to lose politically for him. He risks alienating his Tea Party base, which put him where he is, and to reach back across the middle. And, I'm all for Republicans reaching back across and becoming more moderate. I think that that's a good, positive development. I just don't see this particular issue as being a rallying cry for Rick Scott.
Well, it just seems to me it's such a no-brainer twofer. Number one, you get people health care that they desperately need. And number two, that money then rains on Florida health care people, the hospitals, yeah, the doctors, the nursing homes. It's just a big, huge infusion of money to a state whose economy is moribund. What are they thinking? Yeah.
Richard, you're exactly right, and I can't really answer that question other than just saying it was ideological, because the House Republicans offered a few other plans, and their plans cost Floridians more money because they used Florida tax dollars rather than federal tax dollars, and they insured many less people, sometimes even 10% of the people that we were talking about insuring.
I saw one figure, they would insure 100,000 people.
Right, yeah, exactly. 100,000 people, 10% of what the federal money was, and it would cost Floridians more money instead of accepting those federal dollars. And again, I just need to make the point, because we talk about accepting those federal dollars as if the money comes from, the ether out there somewhere. That's our money. Those are our tax dollars that we're sending off to Washington, D.C., and all we would be doing is accepting them back here. So in essence, the House Republicans denied insuring as many as 900,000 to a million Floridians who were uninsured because they didn't want to take our tax money back. And that's even more un-Republican than just about anything I've ever heard. I mean, you talk about, you've got a group of people who are solidly anti-tax, and we're talking about taking our tax money back to use to put people to work in Florida and insure Floridians, and they're going to say no to that. It's purely political and ideological. They just didn't want to give the president a victory, and they didn't want to have to go back to their constituents and explain why President Obama was right.
Well, sir, we want to thank you so much for your service. You're a man who gives civil service the kind of meaning that it really should have. Thank you, sir. Thank you for your service, and hope you have a good, enjoyable summer before you're called back to help protect Floridians again. Thank you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Richard. I appreciate what you do. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, that was Senator Jeff Clemens. Obviously a good, thoughtful Democrat working to keep Floridians safe from the Republican hordes in Tallahassee. And now, ladies and gentlemen, before we go on to our next guest, a word from our sponsors, the good people at Legal Shield.
What is Legal Shield? It's total access. It's total freedom. Everyone deserves legal protection. And now, with Legal Shield, everyone can access it. No matter how traumatic, no matter how trivial, whatever your situation is, we are there to help. From real estate to divorce advice, identity theft, and beyond. Legal Shield has your rights covered. With Legal Shield, you'll be able to talk to a dedicated, experienced attorney about whatever you want, as often as you want, for less than $20 a month, no matter what happens. Legal Shield will have you protected and empowered to worry less and live more. Please visit www.mrsdd.com. That's www.mrsdd.com. Legal Shield.
And that's the word from Legal Shield. So if you need legal services, give them a call. Thanks again. And now on to our next story. We've got the charming and talented Ms. Trish Shelton, who's going to give us the word on the Stop Monsanto event next week. And ladies and gentlemen, here she is.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Trish Shelton, who is a tremendous activist who's keeping us all informed of genetic food and the related damage. And there's a big event coming up. Trish, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
How's things with you?
Things are great. Doing really good. We're busier than ever here in Florida. We have about 17, 18 marches across the state. And we have, I'd say, at least 12 new lead organizers leading these marches. And if you're in the Miami area, you can find us March Against Monsanto Miami on Facebook. It's May 25th at 2 p.m. And if you go to Facebook page Millions Against Monsanto on Facebook, also you'll see a list of all the marches in your area. And we have West Palm Beach, we've got Tallahassee, we have Pensacola, Tampa, all across the state. So I'm really excited to see all the new participation and our old teams and new teams working together to light up the state.
Well, that's fantastic. Unfortunately, there's been a setback just recently in court, isn't there?
Yes, there's been a few. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're so upset and why there's so much activation in our communities. This Monsanto rider pretty much puts Monsanto above the law, and it allows for the planting of genetically modified foods, even if the federal government has taken them off the market. They can still go ahead and replant them at this time. So it's actually... it's pretty crazy. They can plant whatever they want, even if there are no environmental impact studies. So I think many people are angered over this and realizing that our Congress is being paid to allow for things like this to slip into bills in the very last minute when we're on vacation on a national holiday or just in the middle of the night. You know, it's just these surprise little amendments that are snuck in.
Also, didn't a farmer lose a case as well? Could you talk about that?
Yeah, and I've been so busy working with the marches that I'm not so, you know, well-versed on the farmer. However, I know you've been following it, and I know that, you know, it's patent infringement. But, however, farmers, you know, often don't want to use these genetically modified crops, and especially if they're an organic farmer. And if one farmer is caught, like in the case of Percy Schmeiser with his canola field, not the case in question right now, but, you know, one seed on your farm and the Monsanto police will come, they will find you, and they will find a way to make life very hard for you and sue you. And unfortunately, again, you know, we have people like Clarence Thomas who comes from Monsanto trying Monsanto cases. So it's just such a shame that we're in bed. Monsanto, the biotech industry, and our government are just have such a revolving door. And it's just, it's not fair, you know, it's not right. And then farmers that plant GMOs and the big industrial farmers are the ones that make the subsidy dollars. Little small mom and pop farms aren't the ones that get the subsidies. You know, so we're paying out of our tax dollar billions of dollars, you know, in the last 5 years to support genetically modified farming, you know, and big agriculture, which not only does it, you know, use more soil and more water and more resources, it's very expensive, and the farmers have to pay royalties on these seeds. Patent infringement, you know, so if Monsanto owns everywhere that their seeds go, I mean, we ingest their food. Do they own us? I mean, where is it going to stop?
Yeah, I guess corporations are people except when it comes to answering to the law, huh?
Right.
Now,
it's crazy. So go ahead.
I was going to say something that a lot of people are not aware of, that it's not just what you might think of as a positive thing where they're trying to make stronger breeds or they're trying to make more nutritious food. Now, they've actually managed to put pesticides into the food that we eat. Is that correct?
Right, right, sure. If it's not extra sprayed on top, it is they produce their own pesticide within. So, yeah, I mean, they're modifying seeds from a perspective of using bacteria, viruses, and they're creating their own pesticides. And what's happening when you're messing with, you know, proteins, you can have hundreds to thousands of mutations in just one strand of DNA alone. And just last year, maybe it was 2 years ago now, you know, Don Huber, he came out with a study of horizontal gene transfer. Basically, we eat these modified plants that produce their own insecticide. And the theory is that we're creating new and unknown bacteria and virus-like organisms that are residing amongst our gut flora and replicating pesticides perhaps within our whole body. And when we understand from a health standpoint, we're ingesting these foods from the naturopathic community. We understand the holistic community that gut flora is really our immune system. And when you're disrupting our gut flora, creating an overly acidic environment, or in this case, just changing our own gut flora, you're creating the pathway for these new diseases, in addition to exacerbated diseases we may already be prone to have. And if our immune system isn't working right to fight this, we're going to see a proliferation of all disease, cancer, diabetes, autism, autistic spectrum disorders, you know, you name it. There's so many relationships now between health and our gut flora that if we're, especially with the baby food, most baby foods are genetically modified. So from birth, some children who are not breastfed are having this huge predisposition. And speaking of the baby food, in Africa, apparently, they just took the GMOs out of baby food, but however, not here in America.
Yeah, I guess that's because they hate us for our poisoned food. You know, one of the things that has been, you know, an absolute bulwark of the agricultural community for not just years or decades or generations, but literally thousands of years. Farmers have planted, grown their crops, and put seeds aside for the next year's planting. It's been part of the agricultural economy since literally we scattered berries and seeds as people out of the caves. But this is under threat by GM seeds, isn't it?
Absolutely it is. You know, when the farmer is not allowed the right to save seeds, what is your role, in our food supply? I mean, it's absolutely, that's such a great point. It's not good for the farmers. It's not good for biodiversity of our seeds. So not only are farmers not allowed to save seeds, they have to purchase each year, the herbicide, the Roundup Ready herbicide from Monsanto, in addition to the right to have seeds each year. We're losing biodiversity of seed, partially from that. And that Monsanto has bought up, I guess it's 86%, maybe 90% of our world seed supply. So we're losing biodiversity of food. There used to be so many kinds of potatoes, so many kinds of spinach and vegetables, we're seeing a decline. And then on top of that, some of the seeds, they have a terminator trait. So when life terminates itself and cannot produce more life, especially when it's a food supply, I mean, that has to be alarming. It's like you're messing with our entire world food supply, and this is pollen. That is the bees and the birds, bring this pollen to pollinate. And there is cross-contamination through pollen. And not only that, then we're seeing our pollinators getting sick. And they're not doing their job,
Go ahead, tell us your opinion first, then I'll ask my question.
I just think that all of these signs add up to a large threat to our food supply. When companies like the biotech industry are claiming that they are saving our world food supply, it is the largest threat to our food supply, and they make a profit on it, But yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say, one of the other ways that farmers get in cross purposes with these with the biotech GM food planting industry is that there's something called drift, where plants from a GM crop might through the seed process fall into someone else's farms, and these farmers are being faced with suits. Because they're stealing genetically modified seeds without paying for them, when all that's happening is the normal process of biology where seeds drift from field to field.
Absolutely. And, in the case of Percy Schmeiser, a truck actually dumped seeds, accidentally spilled off of a truck, and that's how his canola farm field was contaminated with GM seeds. And it was that simple.
Incredible. Now, I understand that in Europe there's been a lot more opposition to these GM crops. Can you say anything about that?
Sure. Well, Europe's always been very demonstrative about their food. They're very selective about shopping fresh every day, so it's very important to them. And I think they made it very clear that they did not want GMOs from the start. It took them about a week. They got out in the streets. People were upset and they said, no way, don't mess with our food. And I think that's where we're finally getting to here in America, is we're finally getting out in the streets. We're finally, really understanding this is not some bad sci-fi movie. This is real life. And, unless we speak out, our food's being taken from us. This is our food supply. And unless we stand up for our right to have clean food and tell it like it is. Get the biotech industry out of our government and stop paying off schools and elected officials to push the agenda ahead. You're right. Europe got mad and they got out in the streets and they're either banned or labeled now in 64 countries. So there's a reason. And so that's why these marches are so important, because we have about 1,800 people RSVP'd in Miami alone.
Excellent.
So it is just unbelievable, the overwhelming support for this march. About 500 marches globally are happening, maybe more, and people are really finally taking it to the streets. And I think, look, the only power we really have, is where we put our money. So let's stop giving our money to Mars, M&M, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Kraft, General Mills, kelp, even kashi has GMOs, and they claim to be natural. So natural means nothing anymore. So we need to look at where our food comes from, support the non-GMO project label, support organic USDA labels. You know, organic farmers have to jump through massive hoops to bring us a clean food supply. I mean, everything is documented down to the source. And it takes at least 10 years for the soil to become, you know, usable in an organic farmer so that they can actually have the certification. And when you realize it takes, I think, 500 years to make like an inch of topsoil, you know, that's pretty unbelievable. So we supporting your local organic agriculture, you're supporting good soil that's, you know, composted from organic compounds. And anyway, so yeah, it's really important where we put our money and who we support. Why support these companies that are poisoning us? We've seen a steady decline in health since 96, since these crops have been into play, and it's just on the rise. Look at how sick we are. We are the most sick country, apparently the best medical advances, and apparently the statistics speak for themselves.
You know, one last thing I'd like to ask you about. You know, a lot of activists are accused of taking radical positions and overreaching, but it seems to me the most rational and reasonable position that one can take if you're concerned about these matters is, obviously none of us are chemists, but all we're asking for is labeling, simply letting us have the information so we can choose whether we're going to indulge in genetically modified material. Doesn't that seem like a tremendously reasonable position to you?
Absolutely reasonable. I mean, we should have this right to know. We label all allergens, and GMOs statistically show they have a higher rate in allergies, corn, soy, those crops. Absolutely, is that too hard to ask, you know? And they're downright lying and stating that it's going to cost the manufacturers more money to put a little label on there. You know, look at Kellogg's. They changed their packaging for the Olympics. Why can't they change it to say may include a genetically modified ingredient? All of Europe, they have it on there. You know, may contain a genetically modified ingredient, or does contain. You know, really that easy.
Well, thank you, Trish. Thank you so much. Why don't you tell us one last time, where can people go for the information on these events?
Yes, for all the marches, you can go to March Against Monsanto, either online or on Facebook. Locally, for all the local marches, you can go to Millions Against Monsanto Florida chapter on Facebook also. And May 25th, 2 p.m., around the world, globally, we will have the largest single action in history to label GMOs. And I hope someone's listening, because it's time to kick them out of our food.
Thank you so very much, Trish. I appreciate you taking time from your precious day, and give the kids a hug for us, okay?
Thank you. Will do. Big hugs to all of you. Thanks
okay.
for having me.
Bye-bye,
Take
Trish.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that was Trish Shelton. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to bring on our next guest, the charming and talented, the indefatigable Susan High. Hello, Susan.
Hi. Hi, how are you? Good to hear you.
Oh, thank you, Susan. Susan, you've got an important story to tell us about the legislators' most recent misdeeds. Why don't you tell us about it?
Well, it's interesting because in my last couple hours that I was doing some research, it seems that our legislature, the Florida Constitution says that if 15 consecutive days go by and the bill is not signed or vetoed, then it becomes law. So HB 87 as of yesterday became law. And I am not certain what's going to happen tomorrow morning. I don't know, because I'm not seeing any sort of feedback about it. It's not on the on the governor's website. It's not on any of the normal places that I go to for information as to what happened to this bill.
So
if it becomes law, I know that it is going to be appealed. But in the interim, what is going to happen to all these homeowners who are presently going to court?
Now, this is the fast track, but it's worse than just fast track. Now there's this thing called the final order of foreclosure?
Yes, we have that. That is part of of the bill HB 87, and you have the finality of judgment. You have a couple of things wrong with this bill. In fact, this entire bill is bad law. The only thing that was good about this was that it reduced the time frame for them to do a judgment from 5 years, a deficiency judgment from 5 years to 1 year. That was the only good thing about this bill. Other than that, everything else was bad. The finality judgment says that if the final judgment is entered and the appeal time has run and there was a mistake, sorry, there is nothing we can do about it. You could probably claim damages from the title insurance, but the problem with that is your banks are now only guaranteeing the title for the time that they've held it. And they are issuing what is called special limited warranty deeds. So if
that
the
sounds
previous,
fairly weaselly.
It is weaselly. It is very weaselly. If the former owner comes back and says, you know, I own this property and it should not have been taken from me by an illegal foreclosure, the banks could throw their hands up in the air and said, oops, sorry, and the title company does not have to pay it. The title company does not have to pay that claim because of this new law.
Why do you think this is part of that streamline the process, get everything through? Also, I understand, is this where they've allowed them to reach out to just lawyers instead of judges?
Oh, this is another. This is a separate. This is separate. The Supreme Court, in its infinite wisdom, thought that to push the foreclosure along, what they would do is they would hire attorneys, make them general magistrates, and have them preside over foreclosure cases. The problem with that is, one, we never voted for the attorney. And second, the Supreme Court says that they cannot practice in that area of law. Foreclosure law is extremely complex. And so you have an attorney coming in who doesn't practice foreclosure law, does not understand foreclosure law, and he is determining whether you keep your house or you lose it. It is because our judges, our judicial system, has one picture in their head, and that is that the homeowner who did not pay his mortgage for whatever reason is a deadbeat, and therefore they have no respect for them. And that is reflected in the laws that they pass, in the decisions that they make.
So essentially now there's going to be less grounds, less power on the side of the homeowner, and more ill-advised, ill-considered, uneducated people making decisions.
Well, I won't say that some of the attorneys are uneducated. They're just uneducated in the area of foreclosure. Foreclosure
right.
is no longer
the area
what,
at hand, yeah.
Yeah, it's not something that is in the law books in the last, you know, that was in your grandmother's time. This has to do with SEC rulings. This has to do with derivatives. This has to do with investment into trust. All sorts of law now. And so if you are not practicing in the area, you don't have a clue. And I just think it's wrong for attorneys to be general magistrates because you need to push these foreclosures through. And morally, it's wrong as well. Because when you take, you know, Judge Perlman's bailiff once said to me, we need to get these off our books. And I said to her, so when you get this case off your books, do you realize that this case is a family? And where do you think this family is going to go once you get them off your books? are they going to go into their cars and sleep behind Walmart? She really didn't have an answer for me. She kind of like looked at me as though she was a little confused.
Now, one of the other things that I've heard is that although federal law prohibits a tenant from being evicted as a result of any state court foreclosure hearing, this new law allows a tenant can be immediately evicted as soon as the plaintiff files a motion with the court.
Yes.
That takes speedy justice to a whole new level. Doesn't sound much like justice to me.
No, and the other thing is, if you're a homeowner and the house that was foreclosed on, you're not living in, but you're renting it, or your nephew is living in it, that homeowner now has to pay the plaintiff while the foreclosure is going through. So you are
in
having...
other words, if you're a rental and you're a renter and somebody and they snatch your house, you've got to keep paying payments even though you can't live in it?
No, not the renter, but the homeowner.
Oh, I see.
And it may not necessarily be a renter. It could be your nephew who's living in the house until, you know, maybe he moves to Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But so while the process is going through, you have to be paying the plaintiff. However, let's just say that at the end of it all, you paid the plaintiff and the foreclosure went through, but you won. You do not get your money back. It's not entered into the court register, and the court will hold the funds until all is said and done. So if you lose, then the plaintiff gets his money, or if you win, you get your money back. No, the plaintiff gets to keep the money whether you win or lose.
Well, it seems that the... Go ahead.
This whole law is just horrid. And it was designed for the banks and for the title companies.
The people who benefited from the first part of the ripoff.
Yes, and they continue to do so.
Is this... you mentioned that there may be a challenge in court. Are there other any entities that are already lining up to sue on this misbegotten statute?
You must have heard of the attorney's whose name is Trarick.
Oh yeah.
He plans, if this ever becomes law, to sue the state. And so we're waiting to hear what happens, because it only became law yesterday.
Wow.
If the Constitution still holds in the state, Florida's Constitution still holds, then it became law yesterday. So we'll have to wait until tomorrow and see what happens. But I know for a fact that Matt Widener, he states most emphatically that it will be appealed. And so we have to wait and see what happens, because the 15-day period has run.
Susan, this may be a little out of your arena, but mm-hmm. Do you know who was the power behind this HB 87? What Republican legislature was legislator's bill was this, or who was pushing to pass it?
Let me see. I may have notes on that. Yes, Pasadomo. Kathleen Catherine Pasadomo. She's brought, yeah, she brought it up last year, and she brought it up again this year, and this time it passed.
Incredible. And, well, we'll find out where she's from later. But go on, please.
Let me see. I know where she's from. I know she is. No, let me not guess. So, okay.
Then don't worry about it. We'll find it later. Don't worry.
Okay. Then you have the order to show cause, where it tells that it's an interesting timeline now, because in the past, when you were served with your summons and your complaint, you had 20 days in which to respond. And then there was a back and forth, you know, it's like, you know, imagine people playing tennis. I pass the ball to you, you pass it back to me. And so this would go on, and the banks would sit on it. The banks would literally sit on it because they didn't really want, they were in a hurry, but they could kind of take their time in it, on it. However, with the order to show cause, you now have where you pretty much have a 45-day time frame in which the defendant is now the person responsible for proving that he should not be foreclosed on. In the past, it had to be where the plaintiff had to prove that he had the right to foreclose. Now, it must be the defendant, and he has a shorter time frame in which to do so, because it can run from the moment he is served to 45 days, when the judge will then rule if there is no action, if there's nothing on, then I can just read the file, see that nothing has happened, and rule. And then he could send out an order saying, you need to tell me why I should not rule on this case. And the defendant then has 10 days to object to that. However, with the manner in which documents leave the courtrooms, the judge's courtroom, the opponent's opposing counsel's courtroom, 10 days go by in a blink of an eye and nothing has happened. So I don't know what homeowners are going to do unless they decide to hire an attorney the moment they are filed, the moment they receive the summons and the complaint.
Incredible.
But a lot of them don't have the money to hire an attorney, because attorneys are now asking $2,500 non-refundable retainer, and then $500 a month or $400 a month.
Unbelievable.
It gets very expensive very quick.
And, of course, you have to be quick now because your window of opportunity is much smaller.
Precisely.
And what's the attorney's incentive to be quick? Because he's going to walk away with the money anyway.
Yes, but we don't have homeowners with that kind of money. You know, I was with a homeowner in Lake Worth, and it was so hard to watch her part with $1,000 because she says, it's my home or my medication. So she's going to forego her medication for a couple weeks.
What's it been like in the courtrooms the last month or so?
I find that there are less and less homeowners every day that I go there. I know that they're going to be anywhere, you know, in the next couple of months, we're going to have something close to all told 700,000 foreclosures in the next, between now and the next 3 years.
Jeez.
But I don't know. I don't see 50 homeowners in the courtroom on any one day. I may see three, but that's about it.
Are they just not coming? Are they not fighting it?
They're not fighting it.
Do they feel they have no option?
Correct. Correct. One woman told me, she said, I just want out of this. I have had enough. I want out of this. It is very disheartening to sit there and watch families just lose their homes one after the other. And attorneys go up, and they have valid cases. And they have valid arguments, and they put it forward. I was there maybe about 2 weeks ago, and an attorney won the case for his client. He proved that the trust was not funded and that they filed the mortgage and the note after the complaint was filed. He brought all that into court and he won. The very next week, the bank filed for a rehearing. So it will be interesting to see what happens in that particular case. I'm following that one.
Incredible. And we hear that the bank... Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. Go ahead. You go first.
And also, a lot of the attorneys, I don't know if you've heard of Florida Hardest Hit Fund.
No.
They have been doing incredible work. They have been given funding from the federal government to help families who are struggling. They've lost their jobs and they have, you know, bills to pay and they cannot quite make their mortgage payment. When I first heard about it, you had to be current on your mortgage to qualify for Florida Hardest Hit. But that's not happening anymore. They've changed the rules up a lot, so pretty much everybody has a chance at qualifying, but it must be done online, and it's called Florida Hardest Hit Fund. A number of attorneys who represent the bank, they tell the court that they kind of are aware of how the Florida Hardest Hit Funds work, but they use the money, but they take the money that is paid by Florida Hardest Hit Fund and put it into a suspense account as opposed to applying it to the mortgage, to the loan.
So they're recycling that money into their pocket without giving any benefit to the homeowner who it was supposed to benefit in the first place.
Correct.
Because
we have judges who are not familiar, because now we have retired judges sitting on the foreclosure bench, and a lot of them don't know foreclosure law. And so when I was in court the last time, we had Judge Kathleen Ireland. It was her first day on the foreclosure bench. And she was eventually taken out to lunch by one of her friends who works out of Miami and sort of like explained to her what the foreclosure of the 21st century was all about. Because she looked at the judge, she looked at one of her the plaintiffs in the case, and she says, "Well, what do I do after the summary judgment?" So we have judges who don't quite know the law and don't know what they're doing in foreclosure, and now we have general magistrates who are attorneys coming in who are not supposed to practice in the area, and we have homeowners losing their homes and nobody's in the street.
Incredible. How often do you go to court?
I try to go twice a week, on a Thursday and a Tuesday.
For listeners who'd like to be in touch with you, is there a website? Is there a Facebook site? How can people
Facebook
ask you?
There's a Facebook site.
Okay.
You could go to Occupy Fort Lauderdale. And every time I'm going to the courtroom, I will post that I am going, what time I will be there, and the courtrooms I will be in. And lots of times I sit in the courtroom and I post to my Facebook page from the courtroom of what's happening at the time while I'm sitting there.
Ah. So you're doing some real-time alerts, huh?
Right, and I even had the judge took my phone away from me once because she wanted to know if I was recording. So she held the phone for a little bit, and then she gave it back to me when she realized that I was not recording anything. I was just blogging and posting about what her rulings were.
So let me ask you this. If somebody out there is worried about being foreclosed on. Maybe they're late. Maybe they're worried that they're going to be late. What kind of tactics do you recommend as they're approaching what might be their first foreclosure event or meeting or hearing?
I would say first call an attorney, one who knows the law and is willing to fight in court. It's probably going to cost you some money, but the current law, the way it stands, you need an attorney. And then the next thing you do is you start gathering all your documents. From the beginning when you first made your very first mortgage payment, that mortgage statement, and if you can have a, if you have a copy of that very first check that you wrote to them, you have all that, and you build all that information, you build that file to the present day. It saves you time and money when you go to the attorney. He does not have to be scrambling looking for documents for you.
Now, I don't know how many people I speak for, but I would be really hard-pressed to come up with checks from 10 years ago. Short of that, is there any other way we could, short of that, the checks, just the payment documents, I guess? I guess maybe checkbook registers.
Well, your checkbook registers would work. Your statements that come to you every month saying that you what you paid the last month and what is owed for this month.
Okay.
If you could have the, if you have that, that would be wonderful. But
okay.
A lot of times, a lot of people do it online.
Ah.
The banks have changed hands. For instance, Bank Atlantic is now owned by BB&T. And if you go to BB&T and you ask them for Bank Atlantic information from 10 years ago, they don't have it. And so that, those things become, it makes it very difficult for you to prove your case in a time frame that has gotten way shorter.
Now, is it typical, are judges granting more time? Or are they just trying
no.
to get through this stuff?
No, they're not. They were given $31 million to move these cases through as fast as they can. Mind you, they don't have clerks who understand it or support staff who will go through the files, but they're going to push these cases through.
My goodness. Is there, I don't know, maybe this is very far-fetched, is there a place you could go to look for qualified attorneys who are, you know, charging fair prices, or is that, those are be found next to the Easter Bunny in,
pretty much,
in Fairyland?
I am very much, and this is me, I am very much opposed to the way attorneys are charging for foreclosure. I think it's wrong. Now, I understand they're going to tell me that, you know, they have bills to pay as well. But when you charge someone $2,000 and then $500 a month for the next 2 or 3 years, and there are times when the file sit in your office and nothing is done, I have a problem with that.
Yep.
Now, if you charge them the $2,500 and then as you work the file, you take your time out, and then when that $2,500 runs out, you start charging them by the hour, but you charge them in increments of 1/10 or 1/12, depending on how much time you work on the file, that's reasonable.
Yeah.
But $500 a month, and the some months the file is sitting there, nothing is happening on the case, but you're getting $500 when they may not even be able to buy next week's groceries.
Yeah, that's tough. That's
yeah.
tough.
And this particular form of billing started with Peter Ticktin of the Ticktin Law Group.
Oh. You know, it seems that, as I recall, the two legal investigators who did all that first grunt work to find out these about these illegal robot signings were Florida's inspectors, and they were basically driven out because they found this out. They were working in Florida. Do you know those people? Are they still involved in the whole mortgage deal?
They're doing some cases, but I don't know how much of it they're doing. My understanding, when I spoke to one of their clients recently, is that she thinks they want to start stepping away from it.
I see.
I had one case where it was a difficult case, and she actually said, "I cannot sleep at night."
Yeah.
And so it is very difficult. It's very hard.
Fighting for justice is always hard.
Yeah.
Susan, I can't thank you enough. I hope you'll come back again soon. I'd like to put you together with Mr. Gillis and the other woman I mentioned from the West Coast who's involved in this, and have the three of you have a little forum on this whole issue, because, as you said, it's only going to get worse. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you for having me.
You are a marvel, and you are such a gift to the state of Florida. Please stay well. Keep doing what you're doing. Florida needs you. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much, and you take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I want to bring you a woman of extraordinary talent who is one of the most prolific bloggers I know. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce to you Marjorie Hansen, also a.k.a. Turbo Kitty. Welcome.
Thank you. Hey there. How's it going?
How you doing?
I'm tired. I'm always tired. If
well,
I'm not
I
one place, I'm
feet.
Another.
I noticed.
Let me.
Go ahead.
I have no time. There's not enough time in the day for all the things that I have to do. And when I say have to, I'm like extremely motivated to do them.
Well,
you know, the local action, the getting the word out. The different issues, and then in the morning when I look at all the things that are coming across, not the ABC Network's news wires, but I don't watch TV. I haven't watched TV since the year 2000. What I would consider real news, the things that come across, it breaks my heart.
Let me stop you there for a second. I want to ask about this incredibly powerful communicator, Turbo Kitty. Turbo, let me ask you this. You know, many
sure.
of us race as fast as we can, try to make our little living, try to raise family, help friends, and then maybe occasionally sleep at night. But other people like yourself and many of us, actually say, you know, as hard as I have to work, as busy as I am to keep my life going, to have my friends or my family, I got to do something to make this a better world. What was it in your life that said to you, just living it, just having friends and family is not enough? What made you be the communicator, the publicist, the organizer that you are?
Obsessive compulsive disorder.
I have friends that say,
I have a slight touch of that. You know what? My mom died in 1999, and she was my political touchstone. Like most of us, you know, when we don't know who to vote for, ask your parents, okay? When she passed away, I had to learn how to vote for myself, and I joined a chat room, a political chat room, and it was appalling to me the amount of mis and disinformation that was going around just in the chat room and the things that I was looking up. I mean, I became very familiar with international and national politics really, really quickly. It took me about, 2 years to get familiar with everything and then to correct people when they were, you know, misinforming or disinforming. What happened with black box voting in Ohio. That's a travesty. The invasion of Iraq illegally, that against the United Nations treaty, we assassinated the leader of another country, dictator or not. We're not allowed to do that. That qualifies for high crimes and misdemeanors. That could, you know, like if the world court decided to pursue that, which one day I hope they do, that could bring the perpetrators to the hog. And I'd love that.
Yep, it seems that the those who believe in American exceptionalism seem to think that we need adhere to no international laws, but yet I suspect they'd like people to behave according to our law.
Considering that during the Bush administration, throughout, we never paid our dues for the United Nations, according to what Karl Rove's playbook, we no longer their rules didn't apply to us. Okay, when Obama took office, that's the first time we had paid our dues in two administrations. So that says something. I have to say this. I voted for President Obama. I love him dearly. I think he's doing a wonderful job. However, I would like to see someone pursue prosecution against the previous administration. There are so many murders that occurred for no reason, absolutely none, except for the furtherance of corporatism. And again, now keep in mind, for what I know, I may jump around a little bit, and I apologize for that. However, I'm going to do it anyway. I did a little research on Argentina, and I did some research on Chile. And this happened in Chile first with Pinochet, when he was killing people left and right. And it is my opinion that Bush is just as bad as Pinochet. In Argentina, the same thing pretty much happened. And the basis for all of this was for the corporations to come in, strip everyone of their natural resources, reduce them to the level of serfdom, and then leave them with nothing, no place to live, no food to eat, no job to have, nothing. Now, it's taken Chile, I haven't followed as closely as Argentina, because Chile is not as, I want to say, ambitious as Argentina is. It's taken Argentina close to 22 years to recover from the damage that the corporations have done to their country. They have their party is the People's Party, and everybody votes on every issue. I would like to see that here. I really, really would. At least then, you know, when the majority would rule, it really would rule. And, you know, that's populist voting, obviously. The thing is that we need that here now. Our voting system is extremely archaic. The basis for the Electoral College is that the original basis is that you could read and write and were a landowner. Okay, well, you know, I'm a property owner, so obviously I can vote. I can read and write, so obviously I can vote. But the Electoral College has the power still to change my vote should they decide that I'm not voting the way that I ought to be voting. I don't know how many people know that.
Sure, sure. Okay. You're absolutely right. And, of course, black box voting with no receipt is there for a reason also.
Yeah, exactly. Ohio, they still have the black box. They won't let it go. Blackwell needs to be put in prison. I can think of a few people who need to be put in prison. There's one attorney, or not attorney, but there's a governor of a particular state. I can't remember his name right off the top of my head. But when the Bush administration took over, they fired all the state attorney generals, appointed their own, and then this governor went to prison for almost 6 years.
That'd be Alabama. That'd be Alabama.
Thank you. Thank you. Do you remember his name?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Okay. Well, you know, the governor of Alabama, you know, the original, he hadn't done anything wrong. He didn't do anything to anybody. And he's still fighting to gain back his reputation, his integrity, and his good name. And they accused him of doing things that he didn't do, that everybody else was doing. But he was standing in the way of the corporations taking over. And I have to say, too, approximately 4 years ago, I decided, maybe five, I decided that there really aren't any Democrats or Republicans anymore. There are corporatists and non-corporatists. We've been infiltrated on both sides of the aisle, up one side and down the other. And it took them years to do this, but they did it. Now, I don't know how many people are familiar with, as some background to this, how many people are familiar with the workings of Scientology. Back in 1950, the Scientologists tried the same thing in California. They tried to infiltrate all of California's government, and it didn't work. How this worked, I will never know. Except that the majority of these people who are infiltrators also believe or want us to believe that they are Christian. And the Christian religion is supposedly an acceptable religion. Now, I also have to say this. I'm not a religious person. I never have been. I was raised without it. And I view all religions as a cult. And I also, and that being said, which this relates to America, okay, I want you to think about something. I want to ask you a question, okay? What is the first thing you remember from kindergarten? What is the first thing they taught you to do?
March in a line to music.
Okay, well, they taught you to do something else, too. Put your right hand over your heart. Think about that. And what comes after that?
Sure. We only have 3 minutes left, my dear. Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh,
okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, we're all indoctrinated. Now, I wanted to bring something up that is extremely important to me.
Go ahead.
We have gone through my background and everything else, so people know something about me. The Equal Rights Amendment for women, that is my number one thing right now. We have three states, mine, which is one of them. I'm in Nevada. All we need are three states to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. Florida's one, Nevada's one. There's one more. Actually, there's nine states altogether. And I can't remember the other ones off the top of my head either. However, we are so close to ratifying the Equal Rights Amendment, and I would like to see that happen in my lifetime. Before
I'm too old
to wheel myself in a wheelchair to vote.
Let me ask you one last thing. If people want to get on your newsletter to get your news feed, I think they can go through Facebook. How would they find you, dear?
They can look for me on Facebook or on Twitter. I'm at TurboKitty on Twitter. And if you go to Facebook, just write in TurboKitty in your search engine, all one word, and it'll take you straight to my Facebook page.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope to have you back again soon, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Solidarity, and we're going to pass ERA for you. Take care and have a good night.
Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County, there are no
You'll either be a union man.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. I want to thank you on behalf of myself and my associate producer, Renee Shaker. Make sure you tune in next week. Renee's going to have the reins of the show. I'm taking my night off. It's my anniversary, and I'm going to spend it with my wife, a couple of the kids. So thanks a lot. Thanks for tuning in. Make sure you're here next week for Renee's maiden show. Thanks a lot.
He'll be with you.
Progressive News Network, making a better world every day.
Tell me which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Sing it!
Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Oh, workers, can you stand it? Tell me how you can. Will you be a lousy scab, or will you be a man? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Tell me which side are you on? Which side are you on? Workers, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old union has come in here to dwell. Tell me which side are you on?